We all get hit with knocks in life. Some people call it fate, you know, but we expect to get married. We expect to go to college, have our lives changed. We expect to find a job. We expect to maybe have a family, something like that. But some of the knocks that we get hit with are true wallops that just turn the course of our life in ways that we never expected.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast. Real, raw, and unfiltered conversations with veterans and those who support them. Tune in, be inspired, and walk away stronger.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast. I'm your host, Lloyd Knight, and big thanks to Supply Chain Now. And today we have a very special treat. We have my good friend and Vetlanta member and Army Public Affairs Hall of Famer, Gail McCabe. Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast, Gil.
It's good to be here. We finally made it. Yay.
We've been working on this for a while. And hey, thank you for wearing Air Force Blue today.
I actually thought of you when I did that. I did.
Awesome. So, Gil, where are you originally from?
I was born in Minnesota, but I moved to Phoenix when I was about 6 months old and spent most of my life there until I was 24. And then I went to LA, got a little polish. Then I went to a trip to Germany, met the man who is now my husband of 40 years, and we stayed in Germany for 12 years, then came back to Atlanta in 1997. His father was one of the first soldiers I ever met. Christopher, my husband, is an Army brat, and he was a waiter in the Heidelberg Officers Club, and he served me coffee. And a couple hours, a couple days later, he took me out dancing. And we have been dancing ever since.
You have. And Gail, I must admit, throws the best parties. I've only been to one, but it was absolutely amazing. And there was a whole lot of dancing going on.
Yeah. We just had one a couple weeks ago for the wine drinkers.
Yeah, very cool. So, so you met in Heidelberg. How long after you met did you become a Department of Defense villain?
It's all based on the romantic story. When I went there, I was working in Hollywood. I was part of rock and roll, and I worked in one of the upper echelon recording studios and dealt with the rock and roll stars, the Van Halens, the George Harrisons, the Doobie Brothers, the Prince, and had to take a break. So my girlfriend and I took a break. We went to Heidelberg because her stepfather was in the Army, and that's where I met Christopher. And we just, it was like the eyes met. It was love at first sight. And the girlfriend wanted to go to Greece. So I got on a plane and I went to Santorini, farthest island in Greece you could go to. And I missed him. So I called him. This is the days before internet, the days before cell phones. I had to dig out the coins and find the payphone. And he said, come back. So I did. And by the time my vacation ended, I knew that this was somebody that I had to follow through on. I mean, even though my relationships at that time didn't last more than 3 months, I had to follow through on it. Went back to LA, quit. Before I left, I filled out a job application to be part of the USO liaison for the Army. Figured that would be a no-brainer.
Okay.
They turned me down. They said I wasn't qualifying.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. So Christopher got a job working HR in Grafenwöhr, Germany. So we went there and I applied for and got a job doing marketing for the Grafenwöhr community. So I was working in the field house, handing out equipment. I was putting posters up. One time I went and hired a guy with a camel to come walk through the whole military village, letting people know that there was an arts and crafts fair that take advantage of. And while I was there, that's where I ran into the American Forces Network out of Nuremberg. And because I had audio in my background, I pitched the idea of, let me go down there and take people with me and we'll do interviews that will talk about Grafenwöhr and the 7th Army Training Command. And so they let me do it. And while I was there, I started doing radio interviews, loving it. I picked up a camera in Vilsack, with thanks to an NCO who noticed my curiosity and my hunger to do something. And I went back down to AFN and they taught me how to edit. and what to do and what not to do. And I've tried to stick to that for the most part. And that's how it all started with the DOD. It was it was interesting.
And so what was your first job with the DOD?
Well, the first one was with the Graffenberg community. Then 7th Army Training Command hired me to be their very first broadcast journalist. And so I would go out into the tank gunnery training fields and capture some of the different, like the Canadian Army Trophy competitions, if you ever heard about that. It was a tank competition. Yeah. And so I'd catch some of that. And I went to Crete, where they were testing out a Patriot missile. Got to go witness that. And did a lot of community stories, a lot of family stories. And stayed with 7th ATC for a couple of years. And then I had a chance to get a job in Stuttgart with 7th Corps. And that was covering sports. The guy who hired me was a known former football guy. I went downstairs into a building in Stuttgart, Germany, which is right behind the Mercedes-Benz headquarters. And you walk down this basement and there's mold just kind of hanging, strings of it. That's where they had put the sports people. And this gentleman was sitting in his office and he looked at me and I'm wearing a skirt and a blouse. I'm very professionally dressed. And he says, "You're a girl." And I said, "Yeah." And then he pointed to the camera and he says, "You know what that is?" And I said, "Yes, sir." "Can you turn it on?" "Yes, sir." "Okay, you got the job. When can you start?" And I started covering sports all over 7th Corps, which was the southern part of Germany.
Wow.
And I learned by listening to the audience, what were the words to use, what to look for, what was exciting, what made it work, and got some really, really good coverage on boxing competitions, track and field. In fact, my first boxing competition that I covered, I didn't know any better, had this big old camera on my shoulder. And I said, "I got to get a close shot. I got to get up there." So I got up onto the corner of the boxing ring, the ropes right there. They're going at it. First thing I know, there's this fist coming at me. And fortunately, my husband was behind me and he pulled me off right before I got knocked into the face. But that was good. But football, baseball, volleyball, track and field. And that was the time when we had close to 500,000 Americans living in Germany, those that were in the military, active duty, and then their families, and the contractors, DOD, all of that. And more than one Olympic champion came out of that training venue. It was very, very exciting. And it was very cool.
Late 80s, early 90s?
That was, yes, late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And I realized that sports wasn't enough. I wanted to do more. So the colonel that was in charge of the G1, he said, "What can you do?" And I said, "Well, I can cover all your community events that you have coming up and the family and the school events that are going on, conferences that the officers are having, the different training elements that you're doing." So they let me try, and I did pretty good. And then just bam, like that, Desert Storm happened. And General Fred Franks was the commander of 7th Corps, and he gave them the permission, or he said, "Bring Gail with us when we go over to Saudi Arabia." And so I was there with them up until the time that they went into the desert. Then he sent me back to Germany because I was a girl. And a couple months later, he comes up and he says, "Did you get my tanks in action across the desert?" And I said, "No, sir, you sent me home." But then they brought me back. And I did a lot of coverage in Safwan when they were helping the people recover from the damage that had been done by the Iraq-Kuwait war. That was the start. That's where I started getting into, if there's a crisis, if it's a humanitarian need, if it's a combat, I want to be there.
Hey, here's something you probably didn't know about me, Gail. When I decided to join active duty, so I went into the to the recruiter's office and told them to give me a list of five jobs. And if they weren't good jobs, I was going to leave. Number one was loadmaster, which I ended up doing. and loving and did it from my entire 20-year fourth career. Number two was Armed Forces Network television reporter.
Wow.
And I didn't do it because this is crazy. I was really shy and I was not good at speaking in public, which is, I tell people that about my high school time and they don't really believe me. But wow, would my life been very different? And then we would have probably ran into each other.
Absolutely.
It's a small community from what I hear.
When you assume the mantle of being a journalist, and especially if you're working with a television camera, is you very quickly come to accept the fact that you are a voyeur because you've got this camera that's your barrier between you and what's happening in real life. And sometimes your mouth drops open at what you're seeing, but you keep watching and recording. And shortly after that, you start thinking about how you can take that element and weave it into a story because that was really good and that has to go in there. But most of us are very shy voyeurs. We don't jump out a lot.
Yeah, I don't know the shy gal. So never met her. One of the things before we go into in depth on your story, but one of the things I really enjoy watching you is the strategy you put behind things. Like if you want to get a story, like, right, you're getting that story.
Yeah.
Like if you want to talk to somebody, yeah, they're going to talk to you. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. I remember early on at Bentley and I tried to blow you off a couple times. And it just wasn't happening. But and then another thing is you're a very great on the conversation.
Well, thank you.
So you're able to put people in ease and let them forget, you know, about the light and that there's a camera there. And it's something I've tried to copy, make people feel at home and make it seem like a conversation and not an interview. And I think you're very good.
That is probably one of the nicest, greatest compliments that somebody who works with a camera can get. Because you want to make it seamless. You want to make people just step away and forget. And most people will. But to your point about getting this story, I've gotten very good at hovering. When you know you want to get that interview, you just kind of stand there and hover. And they can only ignore you for so long. Right, Lloyd?
Who's been the top three favorite people you've interviewed?
I'd have to say General Petraeus is at the top. He's up there. He's always been very gracious, very open, and more than willing to work with me. And he's, such a pro. There was a woman that I met in Baghdad. She was a nurse, and she saw that things were changing in Iraq. And so she stepped forward and made herself a military officer so that she could be head of the nurse corps and take care of all the injured Iraqis, whether they were civilian or military. And she stands out. She was a good one. And if I had to pick a third one, I like Tom Capel. If you ever knew Sergeant Major Tom Capel, and come to think of it, Joe Anderson, Lieutenant General Joe Anderson, he was also very good. They were both out of Fort Bragg with the Airborne. Really good leaders, really cared for their soldiers, cared for the mission, and were not afraid to think out of the box in order to get the mission accomplished. They were admirable people, very much.
What about a story that you're most proud of?
In 2000, I had the opportunity to go to Vietnam to work with the search and rescue team with the MIA POW, the Joint Task Full Accounting. And they took me with them out to the rice paddies. We were outside of Hanoi in northern Vietnam. And they were literally searching for any bit that could be determined to be a human bone or a piece of metal from equipment or from a button. And most of the people that were there, if they were not Vietnamese, they were Vietnam vets who had gone out of their way to get educated, to be forensic experts, to come back in and search for their buddies. Every day you came back exhausted, but with tears in your eyes, because it was so moving. It was an incredible mission. I believe some form of it is still going on.
Absolutely. I on my other podcast, The Landing Zone, I interviewed the commander of the POW MIA agency. Mm. And it was so powerful. And no other country puts in the commitment like we do to bring our fallen back. And it never ends.
Yeah.
And I think that's so admirable. But I would love to see that story. If you have a link to it, we can include it on the social media for this episode.
Sure. I mean, it's a half-hour show. But, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
In fact, while I was still living in Germany, one of the stories I had when I was working with the 21st TAACOM, which is a Theater Army Area Command, they did the logistics for all of U.S. Army Europe, was in Belgium, where a farmer was plowing his field, and he came across a skeleton and called in the experts, who called in the U.S. Army. Come to find out, it was a Air Force pilot from World War II that his plane had come down, and here he was, you know, 50-some years later. And they were just discovering him in the fields. And they had reached back and brought his brother over. And elderly gentleman at the time, sitting there in the dirt, just watching as they slowly unearthed bones and pieces of uniform and such like that, so that he could finally take his brother home and bury him. It is very moving.
So we have a common friend, Command Sergeant Major Roger Rowley.
Yeah.
I always tease Roger because he got two Purple Hearts. And they, you know, I tell him, hey, you didn't get anything extra for that second Purple Heart. So that was good bad luck. So you've got the unique case. So many people don't know there's a civilian version of the Purple Heart. And you have the, I'm not going to say honor, but it is an honor because you got two of them. Can you walk us through let's walk through the first one. So where were you at and what are the circumstances?
Well, it's called the Defensive Freedom Medal. And it came about post 9/11. When there were so many civilians who had been killed, and then there were contractors who were being killed overseas, that because they were not in uniform, did not merit the Purple Heart. So the Defense of Freedom was created. And my first one was January 4th, 2004. I was in Mosul, Iraq. I had just the day before come off the what you would call the dangerous mission. And it was a cordon and search. Are you familiar with that?
I am. Our audience might be.
Yeah. So it's a foot patrol. Yeah. They stake out a certain area and they search to find out if there are any weapons, insurgents, bad guys. Along the way, they're going to pick up on any local problems that should be reported up the chain. And I was out there with soldiers of the 101st Airborne. And we were walking around constantly. I mean, if you're in Iraq, your head was on the swivel all the time because you never know who's up on top of those roofs and who's going to shoot, who isn't going to shoot. The only danger we ran into that day were the little kids who, when we didn't have candy, threw rocks at us. But that lasted for about 4 or 5 hours, and everybody was very glad to get back from that. So the next day, I had what in my mind was going to be the easy job. It was the Army Corps of Engineers, and they were going to show me some of the buildings that they were rebuilding for the local government to use. We got into our unup-armored Ford Suburban and took off down the street and fell into what appeared to be, well, I remember all of us in the car going, wow, look at that. They got detours. They're fixing the road. Who would have thought in Iraq? And so we kind of fell right into it. Next thing you know, we're stuck. No traffic's moving. And bam, 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 bam. The sniper fire starts coming all over the place. The major who is in front turns around and says, get down, get down. I bent over to protect my camera. If I don't have a camera, I can't work. And he reached back and he said, we started moving. And he said, everybody okay? It took about 5 minutes for all the shooting and screaming, all that to stop. And he reached behind me, came up with blood on his hand. And he says, you've been shot in the back. So we finally got out of there. The driver, poor guy, he got his earlobe shot off. That was kind of a bloody mess. And we got back to the clinic. And fortunately, on that trip, before I had left, that was a time when there wasn't enough armor to go around for all the troops that we were sending into Iraq. And so my boss had authorized me $500, go find yourself a vest of some sort. So I found a law enforcement vest from a company down in Texas. And I was wearing that, and it was Kevlar. And that Kevlar had kept the bullet from puncturing deeper than a couple of inches. I was very, very lucky. And then when the medic took my jacket off, because it was January, it was a little bit cold, he says, wait a minute, come here, bend over. So I bent over and he ran his hand through my hair and he came back and he says, you have shrapnel burn on the top of your head. And I was like, wow, what? And he says, look at your jacket. And there is a bullet hole right through the collar, right through the middle of my jacket. So bending over to take my camera saved my life. Angels were with me.
Holy cow. I got to ask, did it hurt?
Yeah. I mean, I got pictures up on the wall of my back. It's big old bruise, nice hole. I was very stiff for about a week. My head didn't hurt at all. You know, the hair was a little bristly from being burned, but I think my psyche hurt more than anything.
I bet.
And what was so strange is I went back to the headquarters, division headquarters up there in Mosul, and General Hamm had just taken over from General Petraeus. And we were sitting there eating dinner, and this couple of soldiers came over and he said, excuse us, are you the journalist that got shot? And I said, yeah. And he says, and you're still alive. Our armor really is good. I didn't want to tell him that it wasn't theirs. Theirs was so much better than what I had. But yeah, that was something.
So let me ask you this. How did you break that news to your husband that you had been shot?
Here's a story. Okay, so 2004, there's no cell phones. There's no landlines. Whatever internet you have is very, very thin. It was literally dial-up. When they took me, they flew me from the clinic to the evac hospital. That was probably the scariest part because the pilot did map of the earth flying. And I thought I was going to lose my cookies on that flight. I really did. But they got me in. They did x-rays. Everything was fine. Next thing I know, somebody comes in with a satellite phone. And they said, somebody wants to talk to you. And I said, mate? Okay. Pick up the phone. And it was the Brigadier General who was in charge of Army Public Affairs back in D.C. He said, I'm so glad to hear you're okay. And I said, how did you hear about this? And he says, I'm tied in. I know what my assets are doing. And so that was pretty nice. That went well. So I borrowed the sat phone and I called my husband. Now, what I didn't realize is that Christopher was in Washington, D.C. on that day, and he was working with CDC, and he was going off to a State Department meeting, and he was in the metro. So like first ring, and it's like, hello? And he says, hello, Gail? Click. We lost the signal. I tried again. He says, hello, Gail? And I said, Christopher, I'm okay. Click. It took four tries. On the fourth try, he says, I got off, I'm up, I'm outside. What do you mean you're okay? And I said, well, I got caught in a, you know, bit of a shooting incident. And, you know, I'm okay. Like, you know, I've got Band-Aids on my back, but I'm okay. And, you know, he was very cool. He's always been very, very supportive, but we were both shook up.
Did you go home?
I did. I was supposed to stay another week. I ended up going back into Baghdad and heading home. It did affect me. Now, in hindsight, I wish I had stayed. There were soldiers who got hurt a whole lot worse than I did, and they didn't get to go home. So there's a part of me that you know, wants to stay. And then there's a part of me that gets rational and says, okay, enough already.
And what was the reunion like with your husband? I've had a lot of reunions with my late wife, you know, from normal deployments. Mm-hmm. I can imagine from being from a combat deployment where he had actually been shot, that puts things into perspective. Can you walk us through that?
Well, when I came home, it was coming through the airport and we both had tears in our eyes and big long hugs. And I am very thankful to this day that he did not say, I don't want you going back. He recognized that this is my passion. This is what I do. He did get a little bit more frequent with, be careful. Let me know what you're doing.
Yep.
Call me. There was more of that. And we learned to appreciate each other and life a whole lot more. That's for sure. The Defense of Freedom Medal came around because the colonel that I worked for at that time had put in the paperwork for it. And after some back and forth that was not pleasant, they finally decided to move forward on it. And I was down at Fort Lauderdale when they had the Southern AUSA show. And Les Brownlee was the acting secretary of the Army. And I had to go get him to bring him down to my make-believe studio to do an interview with him. And he asked me all about getting shot and everything. And I said, told him all about it. And I said, and sir, thank you. I understand you're working up a Defense of Freedom Medal for me. And he says, I am. I don't know anything about that. Looked to his aide. His aide said, I'll have to look into the paperwork, sir. And we just kind of left it. And about 10 days later, he called me personally to invite me and Christopher to come up to D.C., you know, so that he could present me with the Defense Freedom Medal. Every secretary of the Army that I've ever worked with has been incredibly gracious, incredibly smart, incredibly aware of the people that they oversee and that they work with. And Secretary Brownlee was right up there on the top, for sure.
You got one, and walk us through the seconds. Honor, unlucky. I'm not really sure where that falls.
I call them knocks. We all get hit with knocks in life. Some people call it fate, you know, but in some of the knocks we expect to get married. We expect to go to college, have our lives change. We expect to find a job. We expect to maybe have a family, something like that. But some of the knocks that we get hit with are true wallops that just turn the course of our life in ways that we never expected. Like you, when your wife got sick, that was a dramatic knock. But I was again on another cordon in search. And this one was down in Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. And we had gone 5 miles outside of Kandahar to a village called Mandisar, which was a known gathering resting spot for the Taliban as they traveled through from Pakistan up into the stands or to Kabul or Jalalabad or into Iran. So the colonel had told me that they had heard scuttle, that there was a threat out there, but if it didn't happen, then we would have a second mission, which would be a medical clinic where the local doctor, which I use the term loosely, had agreed to have the combat medics come in and look at those people, the community that wanted to bring their children or themselves and get looked at and get diagnosed and get some vitamins and some Band-Aids and see a Western medical person, which was really quite a coup for them. And so we got through the cordon and search. It was tense. It was hot. We got stared at, but nothing happened. The only thing that was of interest was this kid who is in a group of 3 Afghans, and he had what was called the Pashtun hat, a Kandahari cap, which is held out for special celebratory occasions, a wedding, or they're having a shura, which is a gathering of the elders, or something noteworthy. But this kid had this on, and it was just weird. We had the medical mission. It was a very basic brown hut. The only thing that made it different is it had a glass window, which in southern Afghanistan, which was pretty unusual outside of the city because it's a volatile place and glass didn't last long. And the women were on one side with the glass and the men were in the other room back behind them. I stayed with the women and I was getting my pictures of all the mothers. It must have been about a dozen sitting on this bench with their children in their lap, all dressed in burqas. Some had their faces covered, some didn't. And I had just gotten this really great face shot close up of this little baby. And as I was pulling away, the mother, her eyes went just like super wide and boom, you know, the whole window wall came rushing in. And we had been caught in a vehicle-borne IED. Somebody had driven a truck into where the clinic was. Fortunately for us, unfortunately for him, the bomb was in the bed of the truck and he had driven straight in. So the bomb hit the people across the street at the local market, all Afghans. And we got the other brunt of it, which shattered the part of the building, definitely shattered the window. A lot of us got cut with glass. I know I did. And that was one of those knocks, Lloyd, where I had to figure out what I was going to do. You know, was I going to stand up? Was I going to run? Was I going to be quiet? My camera had been broken into multiple parts. Wow. And I started pulling the parts together and realized they were still connected with cable. And I pulled the viewfinder up and I'll be damned, I could see something. And so I pulled the parts together and I kind of tucked them under my arms and made myself into a tripod, held them all together, and I could see. And so I pushed the button and the red button started blinking, which says I was recording. Don't know if I was or not, but it's like, okay, I have to make a choice. What am I going to do? And yeah, that's a line that a lot of journalists have to face, especially when they get into dicey situations, whether it's a riot, you know, whether it's a car wreck, you know, you name it. At what point do you go forward or at what point do you stop and quit? And I chose to go forward because I had not done that in Baghdad, and it was a regret that I had. And so I, not knowing if the recording was working or not, I kept recording. I got the camera to focus as best as I could. I kind of turned around, got a little of this and got a little of that. What I saw were the combat medics jumping in and taking care of the injured local villagers, mostly men, some women. I saw a woman through the viewfinder that a army female combat medic was handing her back her baby, and it was pretty obvious that the baby had died. And the woman just broke down. Like, I mean, that tore my heart apart to see that.
Yeah.
And then right behind me, this other combat medic comes rushing in with this little girl who had a piece of glass, I swear it was like this big, sticking out of her thigh. And she was... her eyes were open, but there was nothing. You know, it was like looking into a vacuum. And two of them tried to revive her, to bring her around. They pulled the glass out, wrapped it with gauze. And then we got the call to get out. We had to move. And we had to leave her behind. Long story short, we found out that because of where the bomb was placed, 45 Afghans had been injured. Out of that 45, 12 have been killed. Out of that 12, five were children, including the baby and that little girl. The driver was that young Afghan male wearing the Pashtun cap. Yeah. And evidently, the Taliban had told him that we will pay you to do this and we will give you the money for your dowry so you can get married. That's why he was wearing the hat. My boss put in the paperwork and that led to the second one.
You know, hearing the story, I'm just moved, I'm touched. You know, what has come to be is flee or fight. You know, the and you're a journalist, you fight with your camera. So the you know, that kicked in, and very admirable. Did the, was it taping?
I got back that night after we all had to go to the hospital, get checked out for TBI, get our wounds patched up. They pulled glass out of my, they said I was lucky. Once again, it missed my tendon. And so they were able to pull it out and give me a stitch, and that was good. And when I got back to my hooch, I dusted off the camera. I pulled the cards out. You know, I said a prayer across my fingers. I put them into the card reader, and they read. I plugged it into the monitor, and it worked. Everything that I thought I had captured, I had captured. It was amazing. So it took a day or two to get it cleaned up and edited, but I sent it forward and it aired finally. And that one sticks with me. I ran into one of the combat medics about 3 years after that when I went to Fort Carson. And she was working with the women's Olympic boxing team that was training. And she pulled me aside and she says, "Do you remember me?" And at the time I was like, "Your face is familiar?" She says, "We were in Mandisar." And I said, "Oh my God." And she says, "Do you get nightmares?" And yeah, I said, "I get dreams every now and then." PTSD is something that you run into a lot when you're over in those theaters. People don't want to talk about it, but it's there. But she was doing something. She was seeing a therapist, so that was good.
Gal, you're a complete badass. So, wow. Journalists, we give journalists a hard time. Well, the ones that are covering wars, especially the ones for our government, for our military, you know, hats off to them, because they're doing it for noble causes, and it's that story needs to get out. So
our military they are the frontline ambassadors for America, and so many missions and operations and exercises I would go out on, and you would see the people in wherever, whatever city, be it here in the United States or whatever country, and they would just get these big wide eyes as they looked at these soldiers in uniform and recognized that this was America. These were the people who made it possible for everybody to live equally and to live without fear and to be able to vote. And you especially saw that when you went into Eastern Europe and to some of those countries that evolved and came out from under the Soviet Union. It was always awe-inspiring to be part of that.
One of my fondest memories, it was on a humanitarian mission that we did to South Africa when I was stationed at Ramstein. We went to South Africa for a month to support the Mozambique flood.
Oh, gosh.
And we landed in this little community as a South African Air Force base in the middle of the outback called Hoedspruit. And we hit the ground, 100 Americans, and then we were distributed to little bed and breakfast all over the valley. And I ended up staying at the bed and breakfast that the local schoolmaster ran. And they were very nervous when they heard 100 Americans were coming.
Oh, gosh.
Because the only thing they knew about Americans were Arnold Schwarzenegger movies and unfortunately the Jersey Shore. And I tell you, we changed hearts and minds very quickly.
Yeah,
they completely fell in love with us. I got invited to go give a speech in front of the local school. That school is actually not segregated, which was very special because there was a lot of segregation there at the time. And I spoke to about 200 kids, phenomenal. They asked the silliest questions in the world.
Yeah.
And I got, and then I gave a speech afterwards to the teachers who asked the same silly questions. And it was amazing. So for the international audience here, you know, just don't look at the U.S. military and think war. You know, we do so much around the world for good.
Okay.
And they including our humanitarian missions. So, and if you're lucky enough, Gallus covered many of those.
I worked a couple of really, really great medical missions, military medical missions. And the purpose of that was to get the reservists and the National Guard working together. So the National Guard would, from one state would go forward to be the security and protection, and the reservists would pull all the medical people. And one time we went to Mongolia, and we were literally on the edge of the Gobi Desert. And in fact, there were herds of Mongolian horses that would go racing by in the night, and we got to stay in yurts. And they had a clinic that was, we call them buildings, but the buildings are, they're all mud and thatch that are put together, and they have some sort of little bamboo stakes that run up between them, and they dry them, and they cook them in their ovens, and that's what makes their walls. It's as thick as concrete, but in a heavy rain, yeah, can get a little wet. But this clinic they had set up, and they had put the word out that the Western medics were coming, the Americans were coming. And I remember getting outside this clinic the first day and looking up, and it was like a little valley that kind of went up, and there was a line of people on horses, on carts, on yaks that stretched for, it must have been 4 or 5 miles, all just waiting.
Wow.
This clinic was going to last 3 days, and these people were prepared to wait for the 3 days so that they could get looked at by the good docs to find out what was going on. On that mission, they had brought a cataract doctor, and they had gone into the nearby town, which had electricity, and hooked up her machine so she could do cataracts. And there would be so many elderly folks that would come in, and their eyes would just be totally clouded over. I mean, they would be like this. And she'd do the cataract surgery, and they'd come out, and they would be seeing their children for the first time in maybe a decade or more. It was so emotional.
Fast forward, you end up in Atlanta. You know, your husband works for the CDC, just retired. You got accepted to be one of the first civilian training with industry participants. I can tell you I'm very familiar with that program. I started the Air Force version at UPS about 17 years ago, and I now also run the Army program.
Good for you.
So how did that come about? You became a training with industry. So if you're not familiar with this program, it's supposedly a best practices program, but I don't call it best practices. I call it an opportunity to go learn perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We're a Department of Defense civilians and for active duty service officers and enlisted. So it's anywhere from a 10-month to a one-year program where they go spend with industry. The military pays for their salary and benefits, and you actually get to do the civilian job. But then the best thing is you take all that new leadership experiences, all those new tools that you have, and for you, I'm sure some of it was technology and that perspective, and you take it back and you go make the Air Force or the Army better. How did you become the first civilian to do this program?
I was still living in Germany, and I was the number one field correspondent in Germany for AFN Europe. I did not work specifically for AFN Europe. I need to make that disclaimer. I worked for the commands. But still, for all of that, I was their number one. I mean, I loved what I did. So all I did was work and turn stories. And the people back at Army Public Affairs, they always sent military folks. And there was a gentleman there who said, let's try sending a civilian this time. And so my name popped up, was thrown in. And I was given the chance. I had to get the blessing from my commanding general, who gave it. And military gets a year, civilians get 6 months. And so I landed in Atlanta, and I was like, you know, I'm a one-man band. I know how to do it all. I've been doing it all. Let me go to work for you, CNN. And I landed and came into CNN, and they had me answering Ted Turner's mail and sending back letters to people saying, thank you very much for your inquiry. And yes, we will look into this, that kind of deal. So I got very bored. And yeah, and so I went looking around and started talking to people. And I said, okay, I can work. Make me free labor. Let me work for you. And so I finally got a chance to do some work on the features division. And this was back when CNN was still in its pure state before it had merged with AOL Time Warner. And Ted Turner was still walking up and down the escalators. And there was a gentleman named Bob Fanad, who was in charge of the newsroom, in charge of it all, actually. And he let me go out and do stories and get on air. And I loved it, absolutely loved it. I mean, it was just, you could eat, breathe, live, work the news. It was great. So I called Christopher and I said, I love this. I want to do this. You have to find a job in the federal government back in the States because CNN does not pay. And, you know, I want to come back here and live in Atlanta. And so it took him 3 years to get his job transferred from Department of Army to CDC. And in that time, they'd merged with AOL Time Warner. And I went to the guy who had told me, come look me up. And I looked him up and I said, I'm back. Still got that job. And he says, well, we're a different animal now, and you're just not young and perky enough. And I was like heartbroken. I was crushed. It was another one of those knocks. So I went back to Atlanta, or went back home, and I said, I don't know what to do. I've left my job in Germany. You have a job, but I don't have a job, so I'm going to have to find a job. And just about then, one of my bosses, best favorite person in the world, a guy named Clark Taylor, called me from Soldiers Radio and Television, and he says, you're in the States. I had the opportunity to talk to the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, who knows you from your time there with 7th Corps, and told him you were looking for a job. He said to bring you up and see what we can do. So I flew to D.C. I sat outside in the hallway of the Vice Chief of the Army's office. He came out, walked me down to the hall to the Army Public Affairs guy named General Meyer. And he says, Gil, do you know Gail? Gil says, yes, I sure do. And he says, would you like to have her work for you? And he says, well, I don't have the slot. We don't have the setting for it. And he says, I'll work that out. Would you like to have her work for you? And he says, sure. And he says, well, so I'll let you guys talk. And he went down the hall. And General Meyer, he was very cool. He says, you know, you have a reputation for being somewhat aggressive and asking a lot of the sensitive questions that people don't want to answer, but you do tell good stories. And I says, yep, that's me, and I'm probably not going to change. And he says, that's okay. We can do that. And I said, but I just bought a house in Atlanta. And he says, well, you can go TDY from anywhere. And I was like, cool. Started working for Soldiers Radio and Television down here in Atlanta, and that was in 97. My first story was covering the Secretary of the Army when he went to Fort Campbell. That was pretty cool. And then after that, did a lot of Partnership for Peace exercises and training missions. Did a lot of things overseas. 9/11 hit. And next thing I know, I'm going to Iraq, and I'm going to Afghanistan. And I'm traveling in and out of Qatar, and I'm going to Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, down to CENTCOM. I mean, it was fascinating times, truly, truly fascinating times. Mm. Hard. You went on these trips never knowing if you would have a bed. And I was lucky in that I had a couple of good friends that I had made over the years who were in theater, and I could call them and I say, you got a cot? And they would say, yeah, come on, I'll set you up. And so I was able to get around and do the stories, and that worked out really well. Saw some good leaders, saw some not so good leaders, saw some great people, saw some sad situations, saw some incredibly uplifting situations. It's been good.
And what year did you retire?
I retired in 2015. They were downsizing and they said I could move to Maryland or I could retire. So I chose to retire. And I set up my own company, Creative Media Matters. And I've done a lot of work now with Emory and a lot of work with CDC, with their Center for Global Health. I traveled with their director over to West Africa, and we went to four different countries where Ebola had traveled through to see how the money and the programs that they had put into place were being used. It was fascinating. I mean, these are countries that are developing nations, and they had no national health centers. Nobody kept data. Nobody knew anything. And so these countries have now come around where they've set up crisis centers. They've learned to collect data. They've learned to communicate and track things. If somebody sees an Ebola or a SARS virus pop up, they now know who to call. And I think that's where the CDC played such a great role globally, is that they were able to mentor and sponsor and help these countries develop their health coverage.
Yeah, I was working for my paying gig, and we got contracted to send some vehicles into those four countries when Ebola was going on. And I knew it was a big deal when the Russian carriers were refusing to go in country.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, because those guys would do anything for money. I think it was handled exceptionally well from the CDC. So wow. If any of our listeners or viewers wants to find your company,
that's creativemediamatters.com. Most people reach me by phone or by email, which is creativemediamatters@gmail.com. And from there, I'll send a phone number and we can chat. I have learned with all of my experience that I'm not taking jobs just for the money. I want to learn something. Like the projects that I've done with y'all there at Emory at the School of Business, I'm learning something. And those are the fascinating jobs that I want to do now. I want to come away learning something. I'll give you a great product.
That's very neat. So before we close it out with a couple of questions, Army Public Affairs Hall of Fame, how did that come about?
It was a total surprise. And it was that same great boss, Clark Taylor, because they were just creating the Hall of Fame. I think they had maybe 2 years in, and he had put my name forward. And he called me and he says, well, guess what? They love you in D.C. And I said, really? What did I do now? And he says, nothing. He says, but you got to come up here and you got to be here on this particular day. It's a Friday evening. And I said, what are you doing and what have you done and what's going on? And he says, you're being inducted into the Army Public Affairs Hall of Fame. And I was like, wow, that was quite the honor, because there are some very heavy hitters that are in that Hall of Fame, both civilian and in uniform. And to stand amongst them is quite humbling, and it's very cool. So one of the stories that I did when I first came back to the States was to go over to Anniston, Alabama. And that was also the home of the Women's Army War Museum. And I met women who had served World War II in logistics, in the medical field as nurses, and they had pulled together all their photographs. Some of them still had their gear. Some of them told their stories. That was incredible. And I believe they have moved most of this now up into the D.C. area, where they have set up the Women's War Museum. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. It's very inspiring and very humbling. Things, stories you never hear about.
Beside having throwing these epic parties in your garden, what do you and your husband like to do for fun?
Well, we have two dogs, and so we're dog people, so we take them out hikes all the time. I like to garden. I like to go out and find stories that I like to tell. I get socially active, get my nose into some of the political things that are going on around here. There's a lot of Americans who have never gone outside of our borders. And so sometimes I think their vision is a bit limited or could be expanded if they were willing to step outside. Sometimes I'll send them videos or I'll talk and I do speeches for the Rotary and stuff like that. And trying to keep myself gainfully employed.
And one of the amazing things you do is you do these amazing videos for Vetlanta, which is the veterans club that I run.
I got to tell you, Vetlanta is an amazing organization. When you think about all the different veteran resources that are out there, and it's mind-boggling. It's enough to make you throw up your hands and say, never mind. And Vetlanta brings together not only the people, the faces, the voices, but the resources and the help. And what you have accomplished with Vetlanta, I mean, hats off to you. It is marvelous. I spoke to a lady who works with the Veterans Benefits Administration, and I was telling her about the Vetlanta. And she's, oh, yeah, we've heard about them. We're trying to get something like that set up over here in my state. She lives up in the Indianapolis area. And she wants to get something set up. Like she says, what they're doing is what we need to have done across the country. And I agree.
Thank you so much. So, yeah, it's been a lot of work over the last 11 and a half years. But a lot of fun as well. And thank you so much, Gail, for supporting it. Thank you for being the badass that you are. You've had an amazing career. The U.S. Army and the U.S. military is better because of your wonderful career. And
I'm actually trying to write about it. I forgot to tell you. Yeah. The other thing I'm doing with my post-retirement time is I'm trying to write a little bit and switching to print writing versus TV writing is a huge hurdle, but I'm enjoying the challenge.
I wrote a book. If I can write a book, anybody can write a book. So awesome. You have any closing words of wisdom?
Oh gosh. Be proud of your country, America. What we have and what we have accomplished and what we have done is next to none. And nobody else has come close. And let's hang on to it and let's hang on to each other. Recognize that we are greater together than we are apart.
And I'm going to end it with the words of advice and wisdom I always give. Thank you, everyone, for listening and watching. Please continue to help us get the word out on this. In the meantime, be kind and be remarkable.
The Tango Tango podcast is proudly sponsored by Supply Chain Now. Join the Tango Tango community for more inspiring stories. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. Subscribe to the Tango Tango YouTube channel. And follow and listen to Tango Tango wherever you get your podcasts.